Well, thank you, everybody. Those who know me, I have a nasty habit of sort of diverging from the subject, which I will probably do today. In fact, I'll go beyond 2007. I've always regarded it as slightly impertinent for a guest of a country to talk about the country and its economics, and therefore I've always resisted doing so. So you'll never have seen me at any stage talk about the Australian economy. However, things have changed quite substantially very recently, and I have a quite legitimate right to talk about the Australian economy, having become a citizen. And in that respect, I've always been passionate about Australia, but there's a big difference between involvement and commitment to Australia, and it's sort of illustrated in the breakfast, where the pig and the chicken is involved in the breakfast, but the pig's committed. And so there is a very big difference between involvement and commitment, and you can therefore assume that I'm a committed Australian. Now, I will diverge a little bit and talk about the ceremony, which I found really quite emotional. I thought the ceremony was particularly important because it was done beautifully. But beyond that, it actually marked a moment where the second prior, I was a foreigner, and the second afterwards, I was an Australian. And the importance of the ceremony was the symbolism of going through that, because the expectation is that now that you are different, you must behave differently than you did the second before. And it's also illustrated in the marriage ceremony. I realize this is nothing about economics, but where the night before you have two people behaving more extremely as single people than perhaps they normally even would, they go through this process and immediately they behave as a married couple instantaneously afterwards. And so the symbolism of this really matters. And in fact, I would encourage this symbolism. If we want people to be Australians, then in a sense, it would be nice if all Australians went through a ceremony. And that's not an original idea of mine. It's an original idea of a friend of mine who talked to me about it on the airplane. But nevertheless, and her argument was that 18-year-olds who are about to vote for the first time should go through a ceremony, and that the symbolism of that ceremony would actually bear fruit and then behaving like a responsible Australians more quickly than perhaps they would. And she also said that, people forget that people died for the right to vote. And therefore, don't treat this lightly. Now, so I'm committed to Australia, and I want to talk about Australian economics. Firstly, a very good story in Australia. Australia's just been through a wonderful period of success economically, and nobody can deny that. You could, if you live in Australia and you read the daily newspapers, you could be forgiven that we've been through one of the worst crises in our history. But when you're overseas looking into Australia, there's nothing but admiration for what's been happening here. And the country's been lauded as a consequence of that. And we're now 15 years without recession, which is the longest in our history. Unemployment's a 30-year low. And a record portion of the population is now employed. Inflation and interest rates, although there's a lot of noise about that, the truth of the matter is that although they're higher than they were recently, they're still low by historical standards. Corporate profits are at a record, as is the Australian stock market. At a record. It hit a record yesterday. Australian public finances are amongst the strongest in the developed world. There have been surpluses in recent years, and you can see that the debt level of debt in Australia is negligible, public debt. And the terms of trade in Australia have improved since the early 90s, reversing what was a cyclical problem in the 70s and 80s, such that you can see that the ratio of export to import prices has radically changed more recently, and Australia's terms of trade now are as good as they were in the 60s. So, that's a great story, and it's important that you must celebrate great stories, because people don't celebrate success. You have the success, you have a quick drink, it's over, and then you get back to, well, what are you going to do next? I know that as a CEO. Now, people, though, focus much more on failures. And the reason they focus on failures is that they make failures more often. Now, you might not believe that. And the truth of the matter is this. When you have a success, it feels good instantaneously. For example, I was given the Bank of the Year last week. I felt really good about it. I'm proud of it, and it's nice, and I've got a nice plaque to commemorate it. And that evening, it felt really good. I went to work the next day and actually left the plaque in my bedroom. In other words, it had gone, the moment had gone, I'd completely forgotten about it. When you make a mistake, particularly a deep one, what happens is you replay that in your mind 100 times. Why could I have possibly done that? You know, and therefore it makes you feel bad. That feeling you had of it being really bad is much more than the feeling you had the night before when it was elated. And the problem with your subconscious is it can't tell the difference between the replay and the real thing. And so your subconscious, your brain thinks you made that mistake 100 times. That's why people learn from the mistakes, and that's why they talk about the mistakes more. But it's very important to celebrate success equally to this focus on the issues. So the economic growth in Australia has averaged 3.25% per annum over the last 15 years. Australia's ranked 7th or 8th amongst the OECD countries in that period. Australia hasn't experienced a recession for more than 15 years. It's the longest period for 106 years without a recession. The per capita incomes are back again above the OECD average for the first time since the mid-1970s. The proportion of working-age Australians in employment is an all-time high. Inflation and interest rates are very low, really, the 70s and 80s period. Corporate profits and stock markets are at record high. And public finances are in a sound condition by historical and by international standards. That's what we need to celebrate. And that's really what I came to talk to you today. But there's always a but. And the problem is that success raises the bar. The bar is now raised to make the future even more difficult for Australia, but not impossible. And the reason why it's difficult is that we're sort of tail end of world economic cycle at this point in time. There's no disaster lurking, but I don't think the world economic cycle is finished. At some point, there's going to be a downturn. Might not be a deep downturn, but it's going to be a downturn. And at the same time, many of the drivers of Australia's economic success over the past 15 years are fading, and I want to illustrate some of those. Firstly, consumption's been a very big part of why the economy was counter-cyclical over that period. But the housing boom has ended in most parts of Australia, and it did so 3 years ago. And that's led to the underpinnings of consumption being much more difficult, and therefore we should expect a more flat consumption period. Consumers have therefore, as a consequence of that, become more cautious about borrowing and spending, and, of course, their debt levels have risen over that period also. At the same time, the other side of the coin, you usually get a bounce in the business when you get a more flat consumer area. That looks to have peaked after several years of exceptionally strong growth. And when you think about the export performance of Australia, although superficially in aggregate it's been fine, once you take minerals out of the equation, it's actually been quite poor since the beginning of the present decade. In volume terms, it's weaker than any time since the 1950s. Rising exports of minerals have actually offset by falling exports of crude. rural exports are affected by the drought, and manufacturing and services exports have been hit by the strength of the Australian dollar. By the way, the Australian dollar isn't strong. The US dollar is weak. And so although relatively it's strong, but again, it's not really about the Australian dollar, it's about the US dollar. And the productivity that we've seen in Australia appears to be ending. The last time Australia had 3% productivity was in the 60s and 70s. And of course, the game has changed. That whereas we were facing OECD competitors yesterday, today we're facing different types of competitors, and the growth of the emerging markets, that environment, but also the capabilities that are arising in these new economies are actually causing us to rethink about where our priorities are. Now let me just illustrate some of those points. Firstly, the reforms and the commodities boom have largely driven growth, and you can see those two graphs are generally sloping upwards. And the economic management and reforms of a decade before were the underpinning for that period. We've also had a very strong global economy, and the emergence of China as a major participant, and more recently India, has been incredibly beneficial for Australia, boosting the prices of exports and cutting the prices of many of our imports. Now, there are no obvious candidates, though, for driving another spurt in the economic scene. It's a relatively flat picture, whether you look at household consumption, public spending, investment by businesses, or people's investment in housing, which has ticked up a little bit, and exports and imports, which are all showing a relatively flat-ish sort of picture. Now, the other side of that coin is, of course, in order to get growth, it's a function of population growth, productivity, workforce participation. We need growth in population to have high levels of economic growth. And given the fact that the rate of childbearing in Australia has been relatively static and at a low level, that does mean immigration. It does therefore mean that we need to have a renewed focus on productivity, but more particularly a focus on increasing participation. And the aging of the population, which is really on this particular slide, actually brings to bear how difficult that might be. Firstly, immigration is very important in volume sense, but actually migrants are aging at the same rate as the existing population. And so it's very important to get higher migration, but also you have to understand that in and of itself is not going to help the aging circumstances. I mean, clearly importing younger people would have that effect. Increasing participation in the labour force requires halting and reversing what has been a relatively long-term trend towards declining workforce participation amongst older age groups. I mean, ANZ is a very good example. I think, you know, people are retiring on average in the population, and I think somebody told me it was around 53 or 54. And I decided that we would actually get people at ANZ to retire later and try and get them to stay until their 60s. And so what I did was I actually issued a new policy that we couldn't, because of the age discrimination laws, couldn't tell people they couldn't retire. I mean, that was the problem. We had to try and encourage them to stay, basically. And so we said to the managers in the organization, you know, we want you to persuade people to stay longer in the organization. And if necessary, we want you to introduce flexible work practices so that people can work part-time and transition down to retirement, but they're still with us when they get to 60. We launched this policy, we ran it for a year, and at the end of the year, nothing happened. Absolutely nothing happened. Whenever anybody was asked, can I go part-time in your department, the manager, nearly 100% of the time said no. So in other words, it wasn't a problem of people wanting to stay at work. That was only half of it. It was actually the people in management would not tolerate them actually edging down to part-time, because it probably meant they needed two people sharing rather than one person. We actually fixed it, funnily enough. And the way we fixed it is that we said that anybody at ANZ over 55 has the right to work part-time and the managers can't stop them. And I can tell you, since within one year, 43% of the people over 55 are now with us and working part-time at ANZ. So I'm not sure that's the way to go about it necessarily, but I am telling you that this is a very big problem, and it's not one that's just going to be solved just by policy changes. There have got to be real behavioural changes and, of course, incentives that should be incentivised to stay longer and not incentivised to retire earlier. One of the biggest incentives is that pension funds are underfunded in Australia. My own view is that the mandatory contribution to pension funds in Australia today should be at least 15%. They are 9%. If that is accurate, you can safely assume that the accumulation of 9% or whatever that is near that over the fullness of time is going to lead to an inadequate amount of money for people to retire at a reasonable age. And therefore, how do you build up the sums? The earlier you start, the better. The more you put in, the better. And the later you leave it before you take it out, the better. And the one thing that you don't do is tax it on the way, because that just makes it even worse. And so there's a big issue here. And I'm not saying that we should be like Singapore, but in Singapore, it is mandatory that you put 25% into the fund. And that 25% has largely funded economic growth. And part that money can be used for purchasing your prime residence as well, which is really the major investment that people make. And that's the difference. Now, in tough times, 25% might be too high. Singapore drops it to 20. And when times come back again, they put it back up to 25. So there are ways of doing this, but Australia hasn't found it. But we're going to live with the aging problem of people leaving work, and then the second problem becoming a burden on society afterwards. And that age population is going to rise. At the same time, productivity and participation are not going to rise in themselves. Productivity isn't just about the rate of growth of revenues with the rate of growth of costs. It's actually about having a competitive advantage that allows you to produce a sustainable revenue stream over the long run and managing it such that you have superior revenue growth rates over the rate of growth and of risk and cost. And that is very difficult to engineer. You look at labour productivity growth compared with the 98 period in the United States and Australia. Australia materially outperformed the United States in productivity. And by 06, it is a similar disadvantage to Australia relative to the United States. Now, whatever happens, we have to have productivity levels of at least as good as the United States. And the reason why is the United States is not the benchmark anymore. The United States is yesterday's benchmark. And so if we can't be as good as yesterday's benchmark and try and be good as tomorrow's, we must at least play in the same division as the United States. And you can see at the same, the aggregate labor force participation rate is without aging, it looks pretty good. But when you consider the future age of the population, it starts to look pretty ordinary. That's the bottom chart. Education is a major issue, as you can understand, because that is the foundation for innovation and success. Higher education student numbers have flattened out in Australia. And you can see, if you compare Australia on the bottom chart with the rest of the world, a high proportion of Australians leave school before upper secondary level, and it's the highest level of that group there. I was told the other day that in Victorian schools, and I don't want to get into trouble in Victoria because I live there, but that I was told that 25% of kids leaving primary school to go to the next level actually have inadequate reading skills. Simultaneously, about 2 years ago, a friend of mine from Britain told me that 70% of people in prison in Britain can't read. And it did strike me that there's something about reading and the basic foundation of education that is essential for you to occupy a normal place in society. If you cannot occupy that normal place, then what happens is that you are more prone to be preyed upon by the other parts of society, and therefore you can find an income, but it's not an income that will keep you in the private sector. They'll keep you in prison. And so I do believe there is a correlation between not being able to join society in an equal way and your probability of going to prison and staying there. Because you can't get 70% of people not able to read, and there's no connection between reading and being in prison in Britain. And so this has to change, because without this change, it's all very well getting more foreign students into Australia as a source of income, but this has to change vis-a-vis the population domestically. And then finally, we have created a massive amount of money through this period, particularly the windfall that has come from the success in the minerals boom more recently. Because government investment and private sector investment in essential competitive advantage and infrastructure is necessary for the next stage of the boom. And you can see where it went. It basically went into personal income taxes, family tax benefits, fueling a housing boom, and then fueling higher levels of temporary consumption. Okay? And 10 years ago, I came to Australia. I was sitting at the table today, and people said to me, the most critical issue for Australia is we must do something about water, and we must do something about salinity. Today, people have said to me, the most critical issue for Australia is we must do something about water. Right? And then you say, right, well, what actually was done in 10 years? Not much. In fact, we haven't even got a consensus yet that we're going to deal something with water until there's a crisis. And boy, there's a crisis. Now there's a crisis, sure enough, we'll get it done. But the question is, how can you get it done without a crisis? That's the issue for economics. Now, there are other factors here, because we always think of Australia as a sort of, you know, self-contained paradigm within itself, but that's no longer true. You know, we can't fix everything. We're not in control of everything. And the environment was mentioned in the introduction. And, of course, this concern about global warming actually makes action essential. And you can see there's no doubt in anybody's mind that this is a real issue and that action needs to take place. But the problem is that people are going, as you know, people are going to wait until there's a crisis before it gets fixed. And a crisis is you'll find certain countries where you can't breathe. That's not, that'll just be just simple pollution. I don't know when the last time you've been in some of the major Chinese cities for at least 2 or 3 weeks. It's okay for a couple of days. But again, you've got coal-fired power very near to population centres there, and that's got to shift. Now, everybody's now looking at each other and saying, well, what are we going to do about this? You've had the biggest pollutant on Earth, which is the United States, basically, and continues to be the largest. But then you've got the new economies saying, well, hold on a minute, why can't we have the living standards that you in the West have engineered over these years? And the pollution is now moving, of course, to the more developed world. And the developed world is saying, well, you guys have got to get your act together. I remember seeing an article in an Indian newspaper where there was this starving Indian and an obese American in the cartoon, and the American's saying, the problem with you guys is you eat too much. And so you've got this issue of who's going to take the first action here. I actually believe that the new economies will take action, but they're looking for symbolic action from the United States, given that they caused most of the problem in the first place, before anything fundamental is going to change in this. And I think you might see that shift, because you've seen a lot of leadership emerge out of the United States on this issue. And then the final point I'd make about the change is that global growth is shifting to the new economies. It's interesting that new economies always create higher levels of economic growth because they're younger societies. But if you take the growth post-war in the 50s, it was because of the destruction of Japan and Germany and their ability to start afresh with new technology from there that actually created the consequences of the 50s, 60s, 70s. They were effectively young economies again because they'd been completely destroyed over that period. Now we've got a different set. You've got the large population economies in the world now growing at twice the rate as the developed world. One statistic, people look at economics over short time frames. If you look at it over very long time frames, the patterns become very clear. If you look at the OECD, and I'll try and remember the numbers. If you go back to the mid of last century, the growth rates in the OECD were somewhere around the 5% level. If you take the last decade, the growth rates were half of that in the OECD. And therefore, the OECD has lost growth by at least 0.5% per decade over the second half of the last century. And it isn't clear that that's going to be arrested. It's quite normal to see Europe in the 2% economic growth zone. And therefore, who should Australia benchmark itself against? We look pretty good at over 3% average against those who are 2%, and we all feel pretty good about that. But remember, the world economic growth is above 4% today, and the OECD is just above 2% today, and the other is made up of the newly developing countries. So we can be great and say how well we're doing vis-a-vis the OECD in ranked terms. Terrific. Good job. Yeah, you've won yesterday's game. Okay. Now, the problem is the first division is now these new players. And what do you want to be? Do you want to be the top of the second division, or do you want to join the new division? The benchmarks that we're using are completely wrong. We've got to average ourselves either against world economic growth levels or against the level of the region that we're in, which is Asia. You can see that Asia and the developed economies are now accounting for over half of the increase in growth in the world today. And that, as you can see, has improved very substantially over that period. And conversely, the developed economies, advanced economies, whereas the share of global growth was 65% in the 80s, it's 38% today. And the share of global GDP has moved from 60 to 50. Whereas in the developing world, the share of global growth has moved from 35 to over 62%, and the share of global GDP has gone from 40 to 50 over the same period. Now, this is a temporary phenomenon, of course. No, it isn't. This is the way it's going to be, at least for the next 20 years. And therefore, we better get used to that. Now, one of the things about somebody growing at twice your average growth rate is that over 10 years, they become twice your size if you start at the same point. So here's a good chart to illustrate that. If you go look at 2005 and you look at the economies ranked by GDP in the world, then you can see that that you've got quite a substantial change. You've got the US at number one and China at number two, at two-thirds the size. You go forward to 2015 with sort of reasonably consensus economic forecasts, then China becomes number one. But over that period, China's economy, GDP doubles, and the US's goes up by 50%. These long time frames and this compounding effect have a tremendous effect on the environment that we're in. And you can see India will be double over that period. Japan will be up 20% over the whole period. And Australia and New Zealand will be up 50% over the same period unless something tangibly changes in the scenario. So, I've said Australia has had this wonderful period and we should celebrate it. I've also said that Australia's got some structural issues and some new challenges that it needs to take very seriously going forward. And I'll just finish with three points. The first is the fundamentals of business have not changed, and the fundamentals of economics have not changed. And the fundamentals are, there's an 80-20 to life. In order to be successful, you've got to get the big things right. And I've talked about what the big things are. Secondly, is in order to be successful, you can't do everything. You need to focus. And you need to focus on what's important and actually avoid the distraction of what's not important. And that focus should be on where Australia can really make a difference. And we can really make a difference in the Asia-Pacific region by building closer economic and political linkages and interdependencies with the markets that are going well. In other words, we play in very exciting fields. Now, there have been areas where Australia has made a difference. I believe I'm right in saying that some years ago, Australia was number four in stem cell research in the world. Australia's number 10 in stem cell research in the world. And the reason is there have been constraints on the ability for Australia to develop its capabilities in this area. India's number one. Okay? India was nowhere then. Okay? Now, yes, there are good moral reasons why there should be issues around this. But there are also good economic reasons why there's got to be a way through this. Make no bones about it. If we don't deal with this issue, then the population won't have any access to this more generally. But that doesn't mean to say the wealthy people won't. They just won't come to Australia for it. They'll go to India. And so this is going to happen. It's just not going to happen here. So once you have a competitive advantage, don't give it away to other people, simply because you can't get it done. The other thing is focusing on the non-urgent things before there's a crisis. And I mentioned water as a good example, and don't wait for that crisis. And this is about setting the agenda, taking leadership, which is actually doing something about it, marshalling resources in the right way, and then getting it done. And so it's not any different to running a business. The second is the benchmark has to be changed because the OECD is no longer good enough. Australia is a geographic island, but it's not an economic and political island, and it has to be changed. There is a correlation between Australia's success and the rest of the world. It is no surprise that the world growth rates are helping Australia's growth rates to be high. It's no surprise that the world stock markets are generally at record highs. They're correlated with one another. It's not just about Australia, it's about the world. And it's no surprise that interest rates in the world are all high and peaked. And Australia's interest rates have peaked as well. And the only thing that can change that is any change in the wage dynamic in the country. Barring that, there is no compelling reason to raise interest rates in this country. If anything, it's growth that we should be more worried about. Now, and therefore we should be playing tomorrow's game, and tomorrow's game is about Asia. And that's where we should focus and benchmark. The amount of direct investment from Australia into Asia is negligible. The amount of direct investment from Asia into Australia is substantive. It's one way, not the other way. I'm a member of a group called the Asia Business Council. This is the chief executives and chairman of Asia's largest enterprises, some of them private, some of them public. For example, Stan Shi, who founded Acer, and some from Taiwan, Bao Steel from China, and so forth, and Reliance from India, Tata from India, the chairman of Boeing goes, the chairman of Philips Electronics goes, Steve Forbes goes, Henry Kravitz goes to this meeting, okay? How many Australians do you think are members? One. And that tells you that we're focusing on the wrong game. And the third point I'd make is this. Sorry. Managing the economy, is no different to business. You've got to decide where you want to play and how you want to play. And basically, you've got to play where the money is. And the money's in Asia. Higher growth, higher return. You've got to play in tomorrow's sectors, not yesterday's sectors. Areas where research and these wonderful universities we have in Australia can then be capitalized into economic return. And where Australia has a tangible advantage. And the tangible advantage is, why should somebody do business with you and not with somebody else? That is unique to you and is compelling for them to buy it from you. And that's what competitive advantage is about. So we've got to focus on those things. Now, and making a profit, which is the rate of growth of revenues has to be higher than the rate of growth of costs and risk, and that means productivity improvement at the same time, is absolutely fundamental because that's what creates the capacity to invest. And then finally, that investment can only be done if it's focused. There are a lot of distractions today in the agenda. The agenda is not focused on the main game at all. It's focused on things like winning elections and on the regulation and controlling things. That's all very well. But the great societies in the world are not built on regulations. You'd need regulations because there are some people that are going to break the boundaries and you've got to stop them. But society's got to be based on principles. Principles determine the center of gravity of what is ideal. Whereas a society based on rules creates a society that's verging on the going out of control. If you want an example, you just use roads. If you set a 100-kilometer speed limit, the average is 100, not the boundary is 100. Safe driving is the principle, not the speed limit. And therefore, I live in Victoria, and therefore, why is it that the level of deaths on the roads in Victoria are much higher than those in Britain, for example? And the answer is threefold. You've got one of the largest land masses in the world and one of the slowest speeds. People fall asleep. The second is there's a zero tolerance level. People spend all their time looking at the speedometers and running the cars in front. I would judge any policeman to go through the tunnel on the freeway in Melbourne at a constant speed. It is not possible. Okay, the only way to do that and meet the speed limit is to drive well under the speed limit, and nobody wants to do that either. In Britain, if you drive within 10 miles an hour of the speed limit, nobody books you. But in Victoria, it's like this. And then the third point is that when you've got the oldest cars in the world, then they're not going to work as well as the rest of the world. And so, in essence, it's this thing about not worrying about too much about the regulations. Catch the criminals, but don't harm the innocents, providing they're doing normal things. What is necessary is for us to focus on the main game and not on the unessentials. It's the main game and our ability to harness the main game that is going to be the difference between Australia's success today and Australia's success tomorrow. Thank you.